Here it is.
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if you're aware of it, but Anderson Cooper tweeted yesterday, "With a heavy heart, we have to leave Cairo." I guess the story's over. I have to say, it's no competition, you know. We're not in competition. But with an even heavier heart, I have to say that I never went. Okay? So there you go. Folks ask me, sounds like the start of a commercial, doesn't it? And it should be. You know, folks ask me, what's the best kind of denture cream for an oatmeal eater? Folks ask me, as I travel around the country and across the pond, how are things doing in New Orleans? Couple of indicators today to answer that, help answer that question, beyond my own personal opinion. Dateline New Orleans, the Obama administration acted in contempt when it continued to enforce a federal drilling moratorium after a New Orleans judge ruled that the moratorium was arbitrary and capricious. That's the opinion of that very same judge. The ruling also rebukes an important White House official for creating the incorrect impression that the moratorium had been recommended by an expert panel. It had not. The Interior Department acted with, quote, a flagrant and continuous disregard, unquote, when it lifted and reinstated a series of policies to restrict offshore drilling in the wake of the oil last year, according to U.S. District Judge Martin Feldman. The government, quoting, the government did not simply reimpose a blanket moratorium. Rather, each step the government took following the court's imposition of a preliminary injunction showcases its defiance, unquote. Feldman was nominated for office by, hey, happy 100th birthday, President Reagan. Continuing to quote the judge, such dismissive conduct viewed in tandem with the reimposition of a second blanket and substantially identical moratorium, and in light of the national importance of this case, provide this court with clear and convincing evidence of the government's contempt of this court's preliminary injunction order. Unquote. There go the judge. And another answer to the question came from the Census Bureau this week. According to the current census, which is inaccurate, I can tell you, you know, there's a lot of debate about who gets counted and who doesn't get counted in the census. I can provide you with one datum that is irrefutable on the subject, because I didn't send my thing in, and so they didn't count me. The population of New Orleans was counted at 343,829 as of last April, indicating that New Orleans lost 140,845 residents since 2000. This suggests that the destruction caused by the levee failures of 2005 resulted in more than twice as much population loss as the oil bust of the 1980s, when the city lost 60,000 residents. There are now 118,000 fewer African Americans living in New Orleans compared to 2000, 24,000 fewer white people. The number of Asians fell by 1,000, the number of Hispanics grew by 3,000. African Americans still represent the majority of the city's population and the voting age population. The census counted 189,000 housing units in the city of New Orleans, 25,000 fewer than in 2000. It's likely that many of these housing units are uninhabitable, according to the Greater New Orleans statistical people. To be counted as a housing unit, the Census Bureau requires only that a residential building not be open to the elements. Many New Orleans houses destroyed by the flooding of 2005 are now boarded up and not habitable. Many of these boarded up and uninhabitable housing units were likely counted among the 47,000 vacant units in New Orleans in 2010. Maybe a connection between the number of vacant housing units and the people not returning to the city. Rents, of course, with those that many housing units uninhabitable, rents have gone up, although that's not in the census. Also in the census, 45% of New Orleans residents lived above sea level last year, the highest proportion of people to make their homes above that mark in a half century. According to an analysis of the census data by Richard Campanella of Tulane, featured in the motion picture, The Big Uneasy. coming soon. Not since 1960, when 48% of New Orleanians lived above sea level, have more residents inhabited the city's high ground. It rose from 39% in 2000 to 45% in 2010. It's mostly due to the slow repopulation of the flooded region, says Campanella. Without data about rebuilding decisions, it's impossible to know whether the move back to higher ground signals a proactive residential shift of New Orleanians to higher ground, or simply a reflection of the fact that recovery has been slower in low-lying areas. It's historic, says Campanella. It's the first time in New Orleans history that the percent living above sea level has increased. Neighborhoods untouched by flooding were more likely to buck the trends by adding or maintaining population during the decade. Two of the city's most heavily commercial zones, the Warehouse District and the Central Business District, saw an explosion of residential growth. Both neighborhoods have seen a wave of condominium building. And the buried lead at the bottom of the New York Times, at the very bottom, miner's helmet time, ladies and gentlemen, the very bottom of the New York Times story about New Orleans census data, this. The 2010 census tracked people's current locations, not their past homes nor future intentions. And indeed, says the Times, it is difficult, if not impossible, to know how many of the New Orleanians of 2000 who are not in the city still want to return. It is not even known where they are. Nonprofit rebuilding groups say their waiting lists are long. Unquote. That's correct, ladies and gentlemen. Nobody has seen it as significant, useful, important, worthwhile to collect statistics on where more than 100,000 people were taken, where they are now, and whether they want to come home. Hello, welcome to the show. From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, if you've been following the Egypt thing, even though Anderson Cooper left Cairo, I know the story appears to be continuing. It's goofy. The United States envoy, Frank Wisner, who had been sent over to chat with high Egyptian officials earlier in the crisis, said over the weekend publicly at a meeting in Europe of major government officials that he thought it was essential that President Mubarak stay in office to manage the transition. I know. And within moments, the White House issued a clarification, that is to say, he's speaking just for himself. Yeah, like you fly somebody to Munich to speak just for themselves. Sure. A taxpayer's expense? I think so. To speak as a private citizen. Similarly, you may remember that Joe Biden put his foot in it about a week ago when he said he wouldn't call Hosni Mubarak a dictator. He is asked now in the tradition of the Senate, where he used to be a member, and over which he still presides as vice president, to, as they say in the Senate, revise and extend his remarks. So here is now the corrected version of Joe Biden's comment to Jim Lehrer.
Should Mubarak be seen as a dictator?
Look, I would not refer to him as a dictator. I would refer to him as a dictator.
Okay, so Joe Biden now corrected for the record. And now, ladies and gentlemen, News of the Warm, won't you? The award-winning News of the Warm. And I can prove it.
Soft, listen to the warm.
If my heart wasn't so heavy, I'd get the thing out. If carbon dioxide emissions continue at their current rate through the end of this century, atmospheric concentrations of the greenhouse gas will reach levels that existed 30 to 100 million years ago. That's according to Jeffrey Keel of the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research, the NCAR. In an article in Science, Keel describes how he examined the relationship between global temperatures and high levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere tens of millions of years ago. The article pulls together several recent studies that look at various aspects of the climate system, finding that carbon dioxide may have two times or more the effect on global temperatures than currently projected by current computer models of global climate. This analysis shows that on longer timescales, our planet may be much more sensitive to greenhouse gases than we thought, Keel said. If we don't start seriously working toward a reduction of carbon emissions, we are putting our planet on a trajectory the human species has never experienced, says Keel. We'll have committed human civilization to living in a different world for multiple generations. Keel focused on a fundamental question: when was the last time Earth's atmosphere contained as much CO2 as it may by the end of this century? He drew on recently published research that by analyzing molecular structures, Tom? Help me with that?
Molecular structures.
Yeah, thank you. Anchor emeritus.
Molecular.
Mm-hmm. In fossilized organic materials, show the carbon dioxide levels likely reached 900 to 1,000 parts per million 35 million years ago. Keel could not estimate how long it would take for the planet to fully heat up. However, a rapid warm-up would make it especially difficult for societies and ecosystems to adapt, he says. He estimates global temperatures may take centuries or millennia to fully adjust in response to the higher carbon dioxide levels. So let's live longer, and we'll hang around to fix it. Then there's this on droughts. New research shows that the 2010 Amazon drought may have been even more devastating to the region's rainforests than the unusual 2005 drought, which was previously billed as a one-in-100-year event, and not by the Army Corps of Engineers. Analysis of rainfall across the Amazon, recently published in Science, shows the drought was more widespread and severe than in 2005. The authors suggest if extreme droughts like these become more frequent, the days of the Amazon rainforest acting as a natural buffer to man-made carbon emissions may be numbered. Says the lead author, having two events of this magnitude in such close succession is extremely unusual, but is unfortunately consistent with those climate models that project a grim future for Amazonia. I hear Hef is hanging out with climate models these days, but that's just a rumor. And from the other side of the world, the increased frequency of drought observed in eastern Africa over the last 20 years is likely to continue as long as global temperatures continue to rise. This according to new research published in Climate Dynamics. This poses increased risk to the estimated 17.5 million people in the Greater Horn of Africa who currently face potential food shortages. Scientists from the U.S. Geological Survey in UC Santa Barbara determined the warming of the Indian Ocean, which causes decreased rainfall in eastern Africa, is linked to global warming. These new projections, based on that finding of continued drought, contradict previous scenarios by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change predicting increased rainfall in eastern Africa. The USGS and the Agency for International Development are trying to identify areas of potential drought and famine in order to target food aid and help inform losers. Agricultural development, environmental conservation, and water resources planning. That is to say, yes. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast, and now, Tales of Airport Security. Scott writes, Dear Harry, I went to Israel with my family for my nephew's bar mitzvah. Egypt is so close, so I added round-trip tickets from Tel Aviv to Cairo and back. We were at Eilat, southern Israel, and I decided to take a bus instead to Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, to scuba dive, and then a bus to Cairo. It took over an hour during three phone calls to convince the Israeli airline, El Al, that I was safe enough to fly after having missed the first leg of my flight. I was impressed with their thoroughness, or paranoia. When I arrived in Tel Aviv, I followed everyone off the plane and ended up in the arrival area where travelers were arriving with their luggage. He's arrived from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, remember. Not via airplane. Noticing my error in arriving in the coming to the arrival area rather than the departure area where I should have been, I quickly turned around before the sliding glass doors closed, retraced my steps, and walked to international departures where I boarded my flight to JFK without going through any further scan or X-ray. So much for amazing Israeli air security. Yeah, it's a fluke. So what? Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now, the new F-bomb foreclosure. Why did the HAMP, the HAMP program, Home Affordable Modification Program, put in place by the Obama administration to supposedly help homeowners get help with their mortgages? Why has it been such an abject failure? The nonprofit investigative news project ProPublica shed some light on this. Before he took office, President Obama repeatedly promised voters and Democrats in Congress he'd fight for changes to bankruptcy laws to help homeowners, forcing banks to modify mortgages. Quote, I will change our bankruptcy laws to make it easier for families to stay in their homes, Obama told supporters at a Colorado rally in September 2008, the same day as AIG was bailed out. Timing. Bankruptcy judges have long been prevented from lowering mortgage payments on primary residences, though they can do it with nearly all other kinds of debt, even mortgages on vacation homes. Nutty. Obama promised to change that, describing it as exactly, quote, the kind of out-of-touch Washington loophole that makes no sense, unquote. When it came to fight for the measure, he didn't. Some Democrats now say his administration actually undermined it behind the scenes. The administration has relied on the voluntary program that simply offers banks incentives to modify mortgages. The HAMP was modeled after an industry plan. The administration wrote it carefully to exclude millions of homeowners seen as undeserving. The administration launched the program with a promise it would help 3 to 4 million homeowners avoid foreclosure. The Congressional Oversight Panel now says fewer than 800,000 will ultimately get lasting mortgage modifications. You may remember Eve Smith on this program saying a lot of those mortgage modifications were temporary, and homeowners ultimately ended up not getting the permanent modification that they were applying for. The Treasury Department has allowed banks to break the program's rules with few brushbacks. The large banks that handle most mortgages were slow to offer modifications. To force servicers to modify mortgages, advocates pushed for that change in the bankruptcy law, giving judges the power to change not only interest rates, but to reduce the overall amount owed. As that guest Eve Smith pointed out, that would be to the benefit of investors in the mortgage-backed securities, because they'd at least get something back, as opposed to if the house went into foreclosure. But the administration, in several different episodes during the congressional life of this proposal, it's a proposal called Cram Down. It wasn't part of the original package when the Obama administration unveiled the original foreclosure modification plan. Democrats had originally tried to get Cram Down during the TARP legislation. Obama opposed that, pushed for delay. He wasn't elected president then. But 4 months later, the stimulus bill was another legislative vehicle the Democrats tried to put Cram Down into. The White House again asked them to hold off, promising to push it later. Same when the attempt to include that provision, allowing judges to modify mortgages, was placed in a continuing resolution, which is a way of the government continuing to spend money, even though the budget hasn't been approved yet. We got the impression this was an issue the White House would not go to the mat for, as they did for health care reform, says Bill Hampel, chief economist for the Credit Union National Association, which opposed Cram Down. Privately, administration officials were ambivalent about the idea. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner at a Democratic caucus meeting was really dismissive as to the utility of it, said one congressman. Larry Summers, then the president's chief economic advisor, also expressed doubts in private meetings. He was not supportive of this. Treasury staffers would begin conversations with congressional aides by saying the administration supported the change in the bankruptcy law, and then would follow up with a whole bunch of reasons why it wasn't a good idea, said an aide to a senior Democratic senator. Treasury staffers argued homeowners would take advantage of bankruptcy to get help they didn't need. Treasury also stressed the effects of this change in the law on the nation's biggest banks, which were still fragile. Well, they're doing well. How are those homeowners doing these days? How'd they make it out? Any fragility out there? Okay. Thank you. The new F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen. You can say its name on the air. And this is an update on one nuclear plant that went bluey. Not that that's ever going to happen again. How could that ever happen again? Birds living around the site of the Chernobyl nuclear accident have 5% smaller brains. So apparently they're now being recruited for a network executive position. No, pardon me. An effect directly linked to lingering background radiation. The finding comes from a study of 550 birds belonging to 48 different species living in the region, published in the journal PLOS-1. Brain size was significantly smaller in yearlings compared to older breeds. Smaller brain sizes are thought to be linked to reduced ability. The discovery was made by a team of researchers from Norway, France, and the United States. Norway! Scientists have been allowed to gauge the impact the radiation has had on the ecology of the region. Last year, the results of the largest wildlife census of its kind were conducted in the Chernobyl region, revealing that mammals are declining in the zone surrounding the nuclear plant. Insect diversity has also fallen. Previously, the same researchers found a way to predict which species are likely to be most severely damaged by evaluating their DNA reproductive rate. After controlling for the differences between species, they found that the birds had brains 5% smaller on average compared to birds not exposed to background radiation. Stressed birds are able to change the size of some of their organs in order to tough out difficult environmental conditions. Migrating birds traveling long distances often shrink certain organs as they use up energy. Well, that's what I... Oh, that must be what I... But the brain is the last organ to be sacrificed in this way, say the researchers. It's unclear exactly what mechanism is shrinking the birds' brains. High levels of background radiation cause animals oxidative stress, where they have to use antioxidants in their bodies to fight its ill effects. That leaves animals exposed to radiation severely depleted of antioxidants, and the reduced brain size may be a result of this depletion. So just give the birds vitamin A. What's the problem? Alternatively, radiation could cause developmental errors in the way the brain grows. But scientists say that would lead them to see pronounced changes in the size and shape of other parts of the birds' bodies. Another possibility is that birds are developing less well as there are fewer invertebrates for them to eat. But scientists know of no example of the brains of a wild animal shrinking due to a lack of food. Maybe they're just watching too much reality TV. It's possible. Everything's possible.
It's very clear our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever and a day. The radio and the telephone and the movies that we know may just be passing fancies, and in time may go. But oh my dear, our love is here to stay. Together we're going a long, long way. In time the Rockies may crumble, Gibraltar may tumble, they're only made of clay. But our love is here to stay. Telephone and the movies that we know may just be passing fancies, and in time may go. But oh my dear, love is here to stay. Together we're going a long, long way. Rockies may crumble and Gibraltar it may tumble, they're only made of clay. But our love is here to stay.
This is Le Show, and now, news from outside the bubble. You know, move along, folks. There's nothing newsworthy in these WikiLeaks documents. From the Telegraph in London, expanding on something they reported on last week from WikiLeaks. Secret documents show the British cabinet ministers arranged to meet their Libyan counterparts to give them advice on how Abdel Basset Ali el-Megrahi could be freed. He's the convicted Lockerbie bomber. The revelation appears to contradict the previous government's claims that it did not interfere in the proceedings and that the decision to free the convicted terrorist was taken by the Scottish government alone. Two British ministers agreed to meet Libyan representative within weeks of Megrahi being diagnosed with cancer in prison. One minister met the Libyans at least three times. The British government twice provided detailed legal advice to the Libyans on how to secure his release. Even though officials in London feared being seen as attempting to unduly influence the Scottish government. Last week, the Daily Telegraph revealed how U.S. cables obtained by WikiLeaks show how within weeks of Megrahi first being diagnosed, the North Africa minister wrote to his Libyan counterpart on how the development could be used as the grounds of securing Megrahi's release. A 2007 briefing by General Patrick O'Reilly, director of the U.S. Missile Defense Agency, disclosed that the radar system would be unable to detect long-range missiles in the launch phase because it could only see in a straight line, not over the horizon, like the Earth is round or something. By the time the radar saw the missile, it would be too late to launch an interceptor in time to stop it from striking its target. The Czech radar system was the linchpin of George Bush's Son of Star Wars missile defense plans, ostensibly intended to intercept missiles launched from North Korea and Iran. A leaked cable obtained by WikiLeaks detailing U.S. talks with Moscow describes the briefing by General O'Reilly on the capabilities of the Czech radar, which he says could only see in a straight line. A leading atomic regulator has privately warned the world stands on the brink of a nuclear 9/11. Security briefings suggest that jihadi groups are also close to producing workable and efficient biological and chemical weapons that could kill thousands if unleashed in attacks on the West. Thousands of classified cables obtained by WikiLeaks and passed to the Daily Telegraph detail the international struggle to stop the spread of weapons-grade nuclear, chemical, and biological material around the globe. The briefing states that al-Qaeda documents found in Afghanistan in 2000 revealed that greater advances have been made in bioterrorism than was previously realized. The alerts explain how customs guards at remote border crossings use radiation alarms to identify and seize cargoes of uranium and plutonium. Freight trains were found to be carrying weapons-grade nuclear material across the Kazakhstan-Russia border. Highly enriched uranium was transported across Uganda by bus, and a small-time hustler in Lisbon offered to sell radioactive plates stolen from Chernobyl, complete with tiny In one incident in September 2009, two employees at the Rössing uranium mine in Namibia smuggled almost half a ton of uranium yellowcake out of the compound in plastic bags. Yellowcake, like we were afraid Saddam was going to get. Leaked U.S. diplomatic cables reveal that British officials initially considered Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari a, quote, numbskull, unquote, who would not last long in office. In cables from 2008 released Saturday by WikiLeaks, British government officials offered a pessimistic assessment of Pakistan's prospects. In a cable the same month, a diplomat at the U.S. Embassy in London said the British government makes no attempt to hide from us its disdain for Zardari. They see Zardari as highly corrupt and lacking popular support, simply having benefited from his wife Benazir Bhutto's unfortunate demise. Highly corrupt. That couldn't be one of our guys. The next month, a Foreign Office official was quoted as saying Zardari had done surprisingly well and that the UK had underestimated him. And documents obtained by the Daily Telegraph show that a British Foreign Office minister... Well, we have that. All right. So that's it. Nothing new. WikiLeaks. Move on. Nothing to see here, ladies and gentlemen. Now... And I'm going to back away from the microphone as I say this, because I've been requested to by one listener. And that's all it takes around here. News from AFA. See, you didn't have to turn it down at all, did you? And yet you did. Huh? Hello? Can you hear me? Pakistan's nuclear arsenal now totals more than 100 deployed weapons. I'm going to pop the mic one more time. Deployed. A doubling of its stockpile over the past several years. In one of the world's most unstable regions, according to estimates by non-governmental analysts. So don't say the Pakistanis haven't been doing nothing. Pakistanis have significantly accelerated production of uranium and plutonium for bombs and developed new weapons to deliver them. After years of approximate weapons parity with India, Pakistan has now edged ahead. In politically fragile Afghanistan, the U.S. administration is caught between fears of proliferation or possible terrorist attempts to seize nuclear materials and Pakistani suspicions that the United States aims to control or limit its weapon program and favor India. The Pakistanis are still ticked off by a deal the Bush administration signed with India for civil nuclear cooperation in 2008. You know, more nukes in Pakistan. That shouldn't make us feel any less whatever it is. The White House rarely mentions the country's arsenal in public except to voice confidence in its strong internal safeguards, with warheads kept separate from delivery vehicles. But the level of actual U.S. concern, according to the Washington Post, was reflected last month during a war review on Pakistan's nuclear security was set as one of two long-term strategic objectives along with the defeat of al-Qaeda. Really? Right up there. But a public released summary of the classified review document made no reference to the nuclear issue. Shh. 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 Quiet. I didn't say any of this. And Deadline Kabul. The acting chief financial officer and other Pakistani employees of Kabul Bank have fled from Afghanistan amid an investigation into the scope of that bank's reckless lending and allegations that its shareholders paid large bribes to many senior Afghan officials. Afghan authorities have called in several bank managers, including foreigners, for questioning and detained some in southern Afghanistan. Sherkan Farnood, a world-class poker player who founded Kabul Bank, what could be wrong with that scenario, ladies and gentlemen? The only thing you need is that he used to work at The Simpsons. Then he became a world-class poker player. Then he founded Kabul Bank. Is now under effective house arrest, like he proliferated nukes or something. Other shareholders who took out million-dollar loans include Mahmoud Karzai, the older brother of President Hamid Karzai. Isn't that nutty? Karzai, Mahmoud, as recently as last September, according to the Associated Press, wanted the United States to guarantee deposits at Kabul Bank to stop a bank run fueled by fears of fraud. America should do something, he told the Washington Post. He said Kabul Bank is stable and has money. If the Treasury Department will guarantee that everyone will get their money, maybe that will work, he said. Now, not so much. Oop. Time to check in on Karzai talk.
From Afghanistan Public Radio, at least we're not Pakistan Public Radio.
From the newly defurbished presidential palace in the heart of Kabul, gateway to Dubai, I'm Walid Karzai.
And I'm Hamid Karzai. We're Buck and Buck, the Plunder Brothers.
And this is Karzai Talk. Today's program is made possible through the funding support of some good people who aren't even aware they donated to us.
That's the purest kind of giving. So, I think even my little brother has to agree. This was a good week.
What? The Taliban surrendered? The Americans withdrew? The price of heroin went up? What was good, my older brother?
I'll tell you, old junior one. Everybody was paying attention to Egypt.
Ah, so you're like Charlie Sheen. Sometimes you'd rather not be in the spotlight.
Let me put it this way. If I were any more like Charlie Sheen, I'd have your cell phone number.
And Ricky Gervais would be doing jokes about you. Not so good news, though. We learned this week Pakistan has more than 100 nukes.
Mm-hmm. If I'm India, I'm worried.
If I'm alive, I'm worried.
I have to say, though, I have full confidence in President Zardari.
Oh? You think he knows where all that stuff is?
No, but I have full confidence that he knows where it went. Hello, you're on Karzai Talk.
Hello, my younger brothers. First-time caller.
Mahmood, how are you?
Where are you?
Let's just say I'm somewhere with a stronger bank than the one I own.
Uh-huh.
That could be anywhere.
So, Mahmood, do you have a question for us?
A couple, actually.
Oh, that's okay. We have time. We own the network.
All right, the first one. Mm-hmm. Can I reverse the charges?
I have to explain to the listeners. This guy is probably calling from the front seat of his Bentley right now.
Oh, no. Oh. I'm in the Maserati.
Now, remember, that's got a very finicky cruise control.
Oh, I know. It needs at least monthly a few thousand spent on it. But my other question, dear brothers, is a more serious one.
Mm-hmm. Until we get older.
If a person has in his or her, really his personal possession, some assets that are denominated in dollars, and that person wants to facilitate their passage across certain boundaries.
Or borders.
Or borders, sure.
Will you let the man talk?
Wouldn't it be advisable to convert them into something less easily traceable?
Like euros?
Or like gold?
What are you, Glenn Beck?
What about in substances which, although internationally prohibited, are easily concealed and which have a virtually universal and immediate saleable value?
I can't imagine what he's talking about. What kind of substance would that be?
I don't know. I'm just riffing here.
Such an exchange be pursued, perhaps, in a post-broadcast environment?
Well, in a time when everyone's paying attention to Egypt, all things are possible. Thanks for the call. Don't be a last-time caller.
I won't.
Well, that's nice.
What?
Well, you two didn't talk for so many years. I'm glad I could bring you together.
Don't flatter yourself. Good reason we didn't talk for so many years.
Which was?
We didn't have anything to say.
Well, time for none of us to have anything to say, because that's all the Karzai Talk for this week.
We had help this week from the Kabul Bank. A little bit bank, a whole lot Kabul.
Legal services for Karzai Talk by Ketchum and Nukum.
Join us next time when my older brother Hamid and I return with another edition of Karzai Talk.
This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
Balagandando a balina, maracana do carvana, deixa a chiquita bacana voltar. Mané Garrincha sacana, também nós somos bananas, mas não é preciso sim bananar. Mingus veio ao mango, mas God é que pode que vai dar. Mingus com seu som vai botar o mingau a knockdown. Mingus senta o pau, que o pitecantos tem que mamar. Manda Mingus mani, picau. Mingus me sacudiu, tchan, tchau. Ai, morena faceira, ai, é cubana maneira. Hoje é domingos o meu carnaval. Ai, que a boquinha me aqueça, transforma a quinta e a terça em feriados, domingos de sol. Mingus veio ao mango, my God, é que pode que vai dar. Mingus com seu som vai botar o mingau a knockdown. Mingus senta o pau, que o pita é canto, pois tem que mamar. Mamba Mingus mani, picau. Mingus me sacudiu, tchan, tchau. Ai, que mistura que dá, ouço um zum resedar. Vou com o Mingus e o primo do Neio Domingo pra piabetar.
Ai, 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 ioiô, nego te manda um hello. Já tomamos uma asinha e ao bafo da onça na onda que eu vou. Balangandã da baiana, maracanã do cavana, deixa a chiquita bacana voltar. Mané! Garrincha sacana, tá bem, nós somos bananas, mas não é preciso se bananar. Mambarumus mani pical, menos me sacudiu, tchan tchau. Mambarumus mani pical, menos me sacudiu, tchan tchau. Mambarumus mani pical, menos samba pinga, já de pulga na geral.
You know, it's sort of encouraging. We haven't taught Afghanistan a lot about democracy yet, but we certainly have taught them a lot about banking. Now, ladies and gentlemen, one more reason to be glad one's not working at NBC. You may have seen on the internet this week, it went viral, a clip from 1994's Today Show in 1994, in which Brian Gumbel and Katie Couric were sitting and chatting about the... It started out with the discussion of the A in a circle symbol. And Bryant thought it meant at. Katie thought it meant about.
Harry Shearer, I'm going to get you.
Let me finish, Katie. And it went on to include Bryant saying the immortal words, "What is internet?" And they discussed it. And then, so this was shown on the current Today Show this week after it went viral on the internet. And Matt Lauer and Ann Curry laughed and Al Roker laughed and joked about it. So far, so good, right? Except NBC found out that the original clip from 1994 had been uploaded to YouTube by an NBC employee. And they fired the employee. They can laugh about it on the air, but not in the office. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week. Don't laugh, you're fired.
We're so sorry.
Delta Airlines has apologized for ordering a woman with muscular dystrophy off a plane earlier this month because compliance manuals were out of date. Carrie Salberg was traveling with her usual 100 pounds of medical equipment. She boarded a flight in New Orleans to return home to the Twin Cities on January 13th. She had the equipment approved by the airline a month before and had a compliance letter from the manufacturer in hand. But since compliance manuals on the plane were out of date and she's using new equipment, the flight crew ordered her off the plane. It was humiliating. It was upsetting. It was embarrassing, Salberg says. We just did what we were told. We didn't really have much of a choice. They were put on a flight to Atlanta that connected with Minneapolis, delaying their arrival by about 5 hours. Since she's unable to use a public restroom, she was unable to drink anything during the wait. The airline has sent her a written apology, refunded her ticket and those of her group, and gave her additional vouchers totaling $900. No comment from Jerry. Fashion designer Kenneth Cole outraged many with a message posted on his Twitter account. The tweet, which used the Cairo hashtag that's been employed by Twitter users to denote discussion of current events in Egypt, advertised Cole's spring collection, a move considered insensitive by many observers. The designer moved quickly to undo the public relations damage. He wrote later the same day, "Re-Egypt tweet, we weren't intending to make light of a serious situation. We understand the sensitivity of this historic moment." He then issued a statement on his Facebook page, "I apologize to everyone who was offended by my insensitive tweet about the situation in Egypt. I've dedicated my life to raising awareness about serious social issues, and in hindsight, my attempt at humor regarding a nation liberating themselves against oppression was poorly timed and absolutely inappropriate. P.S. Please buy my shoes." No, he didn't. Allstate has apologized after issuing a lighthearted press release linking crash rates and Zodiac signs. "We recently issued a press release on Zodiac signs and accident rates, which led to some confusion about whether astrological signs are part of the underwriting process. Astrological signs have absolutely no role in how we base coverage and set rates. Rating by astrology would not be actuarially sound. We deeply apologize for any confusion this may have caused. The University of Rhode Island has apologized to the Kingston campus community for not canceling classes Wednesday morning in the face of the midweek snowstorm when it failed to do an adequate job of clearing roads, sidewalks, and parking lots. Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez this week apologized to his people for the first time for mistakes and miscalculations he had made. In a televised address timed for the 12th anniversary of his presidency, Chavez said he had always sought to improve the life of ordinary people and to make his country prosperous and strong. The Peace Corps has apologized to a couple in Georgia whose daughter was killed in 2009 while she was assigned to the West African nation of Benin. In the statement to the family, Peace Corps Director Aaron Williams says it was never the intent of the Peace Corps to make the family feel as if they'd been abandoned by the organization. I would like to offer my apologies to the family if either the former leadership in the agency under my direction could have been more compassionate. The Peace Corps has not commented on the case since it is still an active investigation. The 24-year-old was found dead on the porch of her home in Benin. A fellow Peace Corps worker has been charged with her death. Chicago mayoral candidate Carol Mosley Brown apologized for accusing rival mayoral candidate Patricia Van Pelt Watkins of being strung out on crack. Patricia Watkins said she does not expect an apology from me. She is wrong, said Brown in a statement. She added she wanted to extend my support to families suffering from illegal drug use. Asked if she spoke with Watkins personally to apologize, Brown said, my words today speak for themselves. And my pants walk for themselves, too. Yahoo offered an apology to Windows Phone 7 users affected by an inefficiency that left some with larger-than-usual data usage. The data problem cropped up shortly after the launch of Microsoft's latest mobile venture. Microsoft fessed up that Yahoo had a problem in which default settings on all mobile platforms work. An inefficiency exists in the synchronization of email between Windows Phone mail clients and Yahoo, which can result in larger-than-expected data usage for Windows users. Yahoo reiterated a fix for the problem was on the way. There's no word yet on whether that can be made without users having to update their phone's system software. It's Windows. Why wouldn't it? The BBC has apologized to Mexico's ambassador for remarks on its Top Gear program that described Mexicans as lazy and oafish. BBC said national stereotyping is part of British humor and the presenters did not intend to be vindictive. Netgear chief Patrick Lowe has apologized for any allusions to Steve Jobs' health, which he says were inadvertent in his trash talk towards Apple. And Memphis Mayor A.C. Wharton issued apologies to two groups this week over the conduct of Memphis police officers in recent days. The Apologies of the Week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet. Check with Brian Gumbel if you're confused about that. Uh-oh, I'm fired. At two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast from kcrw.com. And it'd be just like NBC having a sense of humor. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of songs heard hereon available at harryshearer.com. Join the more than 25,000 people who get first word on whatever's going on with the host of this show at The Harry Shearer. That's at Twitter. They were the first to find out about the best way to celebrate Super Bowl weekend and the 100th anniversary of Ronald Reagan's birth. The answer to that question is at mydamnchannel.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.